When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, what's going on, all you dog-loving peeps out there? Tom Davis here, America's canine educator. This is the No Bad Dogs podcast, the podcast where we love, live, and of course we work with dogs. How the heck is everyone doing? We are wrapping up the end of 2020. Dun, dun, dun. And I've been off the grid on the podcasting for a bit. Just I had a move and we had the holidays. Now I'm back in my home office and we're ready to get back to work. People moving into 2021. I appreciate everybody support and I appreciate everybody listening. This podcast has been ranked in the top 10 to 15 in the United States in the last year and a half because of you guys just support it. So I appreciate you from the bottom of my heart, as always. Thank you, guys. We're going to jump right into this podcast, guys, and this is going to be one of my online sessions. This is with a young healer that's really dealing with a lot of reactivity, healer stuff, if you will. We're going to go through the process, the exercises, and the proofing of what we need to do with a dog that's reactive, what we need to do to figure out the breed of the dog, as well as the foundation of how this dog was raised and things like that. So online session, a lot of success, really happy with it. I hope you guys enjoy it. Let's get into it.
Hello.
Hey, it's Tom. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thanks. All right. So let's start off. Just tell me what's going on.
So I have a one-year-old Texas heeler, and from an early age, he's one, and he started showing signs of aggression. I don't believe he's a truly aggressive dog. I mean, I've watched every single one of your YouTube videos and podcasts, so I know that I don't believe he's a truly aggressive dog, but he hates, it seems like he hates anything he doesn't know. He's not afraid to show his teeth. He's not afraid to lunge or bite. He does have a bite history. And so when I started researching on like what to do, I found your channel, and your channel has helped us a lot. He can heal perfectly on or off leash. He knows the place command perfectly. He's really obedient, but with people he doesn't know, he will growl at them. And I have the prong call, the Herm Springer prong collar. I have the dog thread too, ABC. I have found that it takes a lot of time for him to trust one person. Mm-hmm. And, I do a lot of training with him, like in Cal Ranch. I have a muzzle on him. I have his prong collar. And we'll just train to try and get him adjusted to like new environments and everything. And he's getting a lot better with that, but he just looks like a nervous wreck when we're in there training, trying to get him used to strangers and show him that there's more people than just us. And he really only likes me, my parents, and my husband. And that's it.
We've got like a handful of people we can trust, but I mean, he's, like she said, slowly working at trusting people, but kind of, you know, how do we get him to trust everybody to the extent that we can allow him to just be okay and off leash when people come over, or even take him to the park and not worry about him? It's taking quite a bit of time to get him where he is now, but you know, is there something more we could be doing to kind of speed this up? Because it's kind of like he's never going to get to that point at this pace.
He'll be 2 in April, so we've had him for almost a year. And he, like, we hike a lot, and when we come across other people, we'll sit off the path. and he'll patiently wait for them to pass. And it's like 50-50. He's going to be perfectly fine with the person passing, or he's going to freak out. And, you know, I think safety is my number one, and I have the muzzle, I have the training tools. I'm trying to make him feel safe and okay, but like my mom said, I just don't know if there's like a faster way to do it, or if this is something I should accept, that he's always going to be a little fearful of everything.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's first I want to talk about when did this start happening? When did the aggression and going after people start happening?
So the first thing I noticed is when we took him to meet my aunt's dog, he was just fine. And then the neighbor's dogs booked it outside. There was like three of them, and they ran right over to Rizzo and my aunt's dog. And from then, that's the first sign I saw, because it seemed like he was trying to defend himself. He was showing teeth. He started nipping at them. And so then I pulled him away and put him in the car.
We probably had him a couple months before this started, don't you think?
Yeah.
Have you had him as a puppy?
Yeah. Yeah, we bought him from a lady from a local listing. And when I went to go pick him up, he was literally stuck under a third row of a Suburban car. And so I was like, you know, I don't know anything about his past. The lady wouldn't really share any information. And so she had to get him unstuck. And he refused to come in the house for the first 4 or 5 days. He was so scared of coming in. So I don't know anything about his background other than I just found him stuck under the car.
Yeah. So I was just going to say, like, you know, for me, it's a lot of the reality of working with dogs, especially younger dogs, is understanding where they came from. Their pedigree. Breeding is such a big role in how we behave, you know, as dogs and sometimes even as people. I think it's important for us to kind of, you know, peel those layers off a little bit and go through the process of, we had a dog that wasn't stable immediately when you got him. So there's a probability of some behavioral things rising in the future. Not always. I mean, I've had dogs where dogs are pretty resilient, to be honest. I mean, dogs have been abused and whatever, and they come out on top and they just are the happiest, loving dogs in the world. So it's not every time, but yeah. It is something I like to look at to say, hey, the first time I went and got this dog, he was, you know, hiding under a car and not coming out. So we have lack of socialization. We obviously have lack of responsibility, I would assume, as a breeder, because somebody comes to buy one of your puppies and they're stuck under a car and won't come out. Yeah. I mean, you know, it is what it is. I don't want to dwell too much on the past. That doesn't matter as much as what we need to do in the future, because it doesn't matter if it was you or if it was, you know, the guy down the road who adopted the dog, it would have been the same probably behavioral outcomes in the future. But it's definitely something to consider and be mindful of, that, hey, maybe I think the point is you didn't do anything necessarily wrong. It's probably just a product of, you know, what the dog's pedigree is and their foundation in the beginning. The imprinting work that breeders do with dogs in the beginning is pretty crucial, especially when you're dealing with like this type of dog, any type of heeler, Aussie, shepherds, working dogs that are, I guess, historically supposed to be working as a job, you know, full time, the imprinting that you do with them in the beginning stages is to really develop what they're going to become in the future. And it's a responsibility thing, but it's also kind of one of those things. It sounds like, what do you do with Rizzo now? I mean, what's his daily routine? Give me the breakdown of what you do with him on a daily basis.
We don't hike every day, but we do like to hike very often. He does go on a lot of walks. We also do walk to the park down the street, and we have the little chuck it thrower, and his recall is really good. And we like to walk around our block and then up the street. And up the street, there's two big Mastiffs that he is very reactive to. Mm-hmm. But once I got the Herm Springer, I was like, well, this is a perfect training opportunity. And so then we started working on that. And the Herm Springer really works, but really just kind of playing and walking every day. And then in the summertime, we go paddle boarding multiple times a week. Mm-hmm. We were hiking the last couple days. So he is very active, and we do a lot with him. We take him anywhere that we can, but in a safe way, of course.
Mm-hmm. And he does get training sessions. I wouldn't say every day. She recently moved out, so she's primarily been the one that's done all the training. So she does come over multiple times a week and does have training sessions with him and works with him. I wouldn't say he's getting it every day.
Okay. All right. And he's living, where is Rizzo living now?
At my parents' house with me, my husband.
Okay. All right. So.
And we have another dog too. Maybe we should let you know that now.
Okay. Is he good with the other dog?
Yeah. He's really good, but I've noticed like with his breed, I know he's a healer.
Yeah.
He nips at heels. He does love to nip at her heels, but he knows the leave it command. So we are always saying, Rizzo, leave it, and then he'll leave her alone. And then a few minutes later, he thinks he can get away with it again. So then we say, Rizzo, leave it.
He is pretty dominant with her, but not in a dangerous way.
Yeah.
He a playful way for him, but he's pretty dominant.
Okay.
He used to not share his toys, per se.
Mm-hmm.
He used to resource guard everything, but now he doesn't do that anymore. He's good. With that, now he knows, okay, Presley can have a turn to fetch the ball. Rizzo can have a turn to fetch the ball. So he's now sharing now. But he, overall, he's really good with our other dog.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, that's good. That's good. But moving forward from that, I think, getting down to the reason why you guys called is like the reactivity. I mean, obviously my goal and my job is to always try to change the perception of the dog's issues, meaning if he's lunging at people, I want him to feel like he doesn't have to lunge at people and not necessarily just make him not lunge at people because he's going to get punished. Although, in my opinion, I think that suppressing a behavior is better if you can't modify it. Suppressing it is better because there's certain dogs who literally just won't ever change. They don't like one of my personal dogs like just doesn't like other dogs. And I know that, and I can control that. He's successful and he's fine. And I have to advocate him for him often. But the point is him being around other dogs, that modification isn't changed of like all of a sudden he likes dogs and it's not necessarily suppressed to a point where he's like always constantly wanting to go after dogs and he's sitting there waiting for an opportunity. But he doesn't like the other dogs, but he also respects that he can't go after the other dogs and he's chill and he relaxes. So my point is in this situation, those are like the two things that we're going to be talking about. Those are the two like outcomes we're going to be talking about. The two big things that are going to be our goals is to try to modify the behavior and try to change that thinking of the dog and how he perceives the other dogs. So with Rizzo or other people, or both, I guess. So Rizzo, with other people, when you're out, walk me through like a situation that you commonly will deal with that's problematic for you that you'll see a lot.
So I'm trying to think of like which situation to use. Really in more like public places, like when I take him hiking, we'll walk. If I can see clear on the path ahead of me,
mm-hmm.
he'll be off leash. He'll stay right by me and everything. If I see someone coming, we'll put him on leash. And I usually watch his behavior and look at the other dogs or other person as well.
Mm-hmm.
If I have enough space to where we can walk right past him, he'll be fine. I can just say, Rizzo, leave it. He'll redirect his attention on me rather than the subject. But if it's a tighter space and I can tell that the dog is kind of wild, mm-hmm. we'll pull off to the path. I'll stand in front of him and tell him to sit. Mm-hmm. And then as they pass, I watch his behavior, because I know you say don't let the dog get to a boiling point. Right. So I try and watch for that. And
of course, the closer either the person or the dog is to him, the more likely he is to lunge, to growl, show his teeth. I wouldn't say it's every time, but there's definitely, I mean,
it's like if the other dog or the other person is interested in Rizzo or tries to pet him without asking, which I would never let someone pet him for everybody's safety, whether he has a muzzle on or not. And same with other dogs, because I know other dogs are nice. And if they come over and want to say hi to Rizzo, he doesn't like that. He wants his space to be respected, and he doesn't like anybody or anything in his personal space.
And it's somewhat random.
Random.
I can't pick anything out that's specific. I mean, most of the time, nobody tries to approach him or anything. If we have him out in public, the muzzle's on, and of course, it kind of gives the people the indication,
and
leave the dog alone, which they do. And even if they do leave him alone and they're walking by, they're still,
it's random.
It's just random. He still tries to lunge or growl.
But I tell people, I say he's working on his social skills, because I don't want people to be too scared, but I want them to understand that he's in training, he's working on himself.
Sure. So is it, just to, I guess, go back to this, the real problem is you're fine if you have some space, but he kind of gets reactive when you have tighter spaces or when dogs come up to him off leash and things like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
But at home as well, I mean, if he's at a distance from people, you know, he's on a leash, he still shows signs of aggression with, you know, if someone's at the house and he sees them. If someone's at the fence, he gets super aggressive.
He's, yep.
Even at a distance, but it still happens at a distance.
What are you guys doing to correct it? Say you're out for a walk, he sees another dog, you have a tighter space, maybe a sidewalk where you can't cross the road. What's your process? What do you do handling wise?
I have the I have the Herm Springer on, and I tell him to leave it. If he looks like he's trying to go to react, then I just give him the little pop, and we just keep walking.
Okay.
If the situation's rising, then we'll just either change directions, create more distance, let the other people know, hey, like, my dog's not going to be okay with you, or
yeah,
kind of rude the situation.
Now, how does he respond to the corrections when you correct him?
The first time I corrected him, he bit me in the knee.
Mm-hmm.
But from then on with the corrections, he's like, okay, Mom. Okay, like, I get it.
Yep. Yeah.
He generally listens to the correction.
He does?
Yeah.
Okay.
But there's the unknown of how much he's going to lunge, how much he's going to growl, how much he's going to try to go towards the dog or the person.
Right. So, you know, and I talk about this a lot in my videos and stuff, is if you have a dog that is reactive to other dogs and you get into a tight spot, there's not much you can do. So for me, there's a lot of, I don't want to say management, but it is a lot of management on your end of like where you go, where you bring him. Same thing again, if I had, you know, with one of my dogs, if they don't like other dogs, I'm not going to be able to change that, modify that. I can manage it where I'm not going to go to places where there's off-leash dogs. I'm not going to go to places where dogs are, and that's, you know, that's just the world that we live in, where that could literally happen anywhere at any time, unfortunately. Excuse me. But I think it is important for you to make sure that you're not trying to bite off more than you can chew and try to, you know, stick a triangle in a square peg, where he's never going to be okay, potentially. I mean, there's a potential, I guess I should say. There's a potential of him never being comfortable and well-behaved in close encounters with dogs he doesn't know. And in my opinion, that's somewhat respectable, because your success is going to be predicated from the other dog's training. So if you're out and Rizzo's in a nice heel paying attention to you and minding his own business, and the other dog is on a flexi as their owner is sending an email, there's nothing you can do to make that situation better other than to look at it and go, I gotta get out of here. This isn't good for anybody, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first layer to peel off, is just saying, just avoid places where there's going to be habitual, nonstop, you know, dog owners just not being responsible, which is pretty much anywhere. So giving yourself some space, not going down those small spaces, not going down those small roads, having a game plan to say, that's what I do. I mean, when I'm out for a walk, in places that I'm unsure of and I don't know where dogs are going to potentially be and things like that, I say, okay, here's what I'm going to do if something happens. And it sucks that I even have to do that, because it has nothing to do with my dogs. It has everything to do with other people's dogs. Because I know that my dogs are going to be responsive because I've spent the time to train with them. That's, you know, so other people's dogs are going to be, unfortunately, the, you know, deciding factor on whether or not you're going to be successful or not, which sucks. But it's just the reality of what we have to deal with as dog owners in general. So anyway, there's that, but also making sure that your leave it command is being associated with the correction properly. So a lot of people go out, put the prong collar on, and they're very inconsistent with their verbal cues. So if he reacts and you say no, pop, leave it, pop, stop, pop, it's just a puppy, pop, whatever, that's not going to create that conditioning that we want. So the other thing with corrections, just like when we teach dogs behaviors with food, like when we're teaching with motivation, right, we want the dog to learn a behavior through motivation, which is great. I mean, that's a huge part of any type of training. It doesn't matter if you're teaching kids to do good on tests and feeding them, candy after or whatever. We want them to sustainably understand that this is what I want you to do. And then the food kind of goes away and the reward goes away and they just learn it, right? Same thing with corrections on that end of the spectrum of when you're adding punishment, you want the verbal to tell the dog. Like if you say leave it, and then you condition the dog to say, if you don't leave it, you're going to get punished. Therefore, in the future, like you said, he kind of like takes a step back and he says, okay, mom, I'm not going to react. That's great. You just want to make sure you have like a clear marker on that and you're not just depending on the prong collar to make that deciding factor. That's your enforcer, which is important to have. That's your leverage. I mean, when you're working with dogs, we can't sit down and have a conversation with them. We have to communicate them assertively right there and then when it happens. So he reacts, you say leave it, he continues to react, you punish him. The next time you say leave it, he takes a step back and recluses a little bit from the situation. Good, leave it. And he goes, aha, bang, right? Operant conditioning. So that's just the first thing, because I always like to talk about that, because a lot of people don't condition their dogs properly on the leash with any type of correction. And it doesn't matter if you're using martingale, prong collar, slip collar, e-collar, whatever. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's that. But also, too, you should, I always like to use counter conditioning obedience to get a dog out of a situation too. So that means your heel and potentially your sit or your focus or your look or all of the above, which means you have to have a game plan, because you can't handle the other dog and you don't know what the other dog's going to do. You have to control what you can control in order to be successful with your dog. You can't just assume, oh, well, my dog's in a perfect sit, minding his own business, this other dog's going to do the same thing. Well, that doesn't work like that. So you just have to have a game plan as a dog owner to say, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to, so redirective healing, right? Something I do very often. I call it a tune-up, or I'll call it a calibration. But one thing that I find with dog owners who come in with any behavioral problem is the simple fact that they don't have control over their dog on a very small level, on a very novice level. What makes anybody think that they're going to be able to do that, you know, when there's a distraction or there's something that they're really intrigued by? It's not going to happen. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's something that you have to pay attention to say, hey, how is my obedience in general? So if you go out and you're on the leash and you say Rizzo heel and you turn at 180 and you go the other way and he just keeps going straight, that's a problem. He's not really that engaged with you. So you have to create engagement with your dog also on the leash in order to be successful with your obedience. So you turn and go the other way, your dog's right with you. So that's that tune up that I do often. The other thing you could do is just like put him into a sit, and you know, your sit just alone, if it's good, will help with the reactivity. I do understand that there's a lot of variables in there about where you're at and what you can do and what you can't do with the terrain and things like that. But if you put your dog into a sit and it's great, you're probably not going to get a lot of reactivity.
Okay. So, with the sitting for the reactivity, like when we're on a hike, sorry, my brain's kind of stopped working now. Mm-hmm. So what do you think would make him react? Because when we put him in a sit and we're slightly off the trail waiting for other people to pass, what do you think like makes him get up from the sit? Because once he gets up, it's kind of hard to put him back into it because he just wants to react.
Yeah, it's a great question. I have a feeling, you know, and this happens frequently and often with dog owners, is what makes him get up is the practice that you put outside of the situation of the sit. I mean, why do we train? Why do we teach our dog sit? Why do we teach our dog down, place, sit, stay, whatever? That's why it's important for these obedience behaviors to be really good. And that's what I was talking about with your, like, again, you came in, right? And this happens, I mean, it's like clockwork. And it's so successful to break through with dogs in this manner because it really is eye-opening for dog owners to realize that they don't have control of their dog on a very small level, like I said before. And so the point is if your dog is getting up out of their sit, that means that their sit in general hasn't been proofed or worked on well enough for them to sustainably sit no matter what happens. So your answer is your dog's not sitting because the obedience just isn't tight enough.
Okay.
So if you're getting into a situation where you say sit and then literally a dog walks by, bang, he pops up. That means that you need to work on that sit more in the context of distractions.
Okay. So, I mean, should we expect that he shouldn't be getting up out of that sit at all to determine whether we've spent an amount of time on it?
Right.
Because that's what I've worked on a lot with him is he doesn't get up from his place until I say break. He doesn't stop peeling until I say break. He knows not to run out the front door. This is another weird situation. So Rizzo loves my husband, and the other day he came over with his friend. Rizzo hates his friend. And Rizzo had a muzzle on. I had him sitting in the front yard, and to not move. And then I called Rizzo over to me, and he came and he sat right next to me. And my husband Jason wanted to come say hi to Rizzo. So the friend stayed where he was. Jason came to say hi to Rizzo, and Rizzo like attacked him basically, but he had never done that to my husband before. But my thought process was his attention was focused on the friend he hates, but took it out on my husband. So I just thought that was really weird.
Sure. But he's generally really comfortable with her husband. He can be trusted. Right. With her husband.
Yeah, it's the same thing that you were saying before about the prong collar redirection. Is you have a dog that is fears nothing.
Okay.
That's their job is to fear nothing except like the Tasmanian devil himself. Okay. I mean, healers are not great pets, like ever. Like they really, really need a job. I haven't seen a healer in a home do well with not a job, meaning getting up, going to the barn, running this, running that, whatever. They are such high caliber working dogs. And if you don't utilize them as such, they will then start taking that working drive out on other things.
Okay.
But to answer your question, it's the same thing you saw with the prong collar. It's redirection. Very common. Okay. You have a dog that builds and boils really quickly, has a lot to say, has a lot to prove, really wants to work, really wants to heal and herd and get things done, and we don't allow them to do it, and they get ticked off, and they redirect at the closest thing. So same thing on the leash when Rizzo's building, and then you correct him, and then he snaps, and he gets pissed, and he redirects on you. It's the same thing. He sees that guy he doesn't like, builds. Your husband does anything to keep Rizzo from this guy, and then, you know, they get nailed. Very common. It's not appropriate, but in theory, it does make sense, unfortunately.
Okay. So how much of a job, you know, working would you say he would need to have in order to be appropriate? I mean, you know, we're kind of limited to what the jobs could be. Could be running, you know, could be just going running with him.
Yeah.
Is it enough of a job to suffice for having,
I think it's going to be more mental than anything. I think the mental, I mean, this is a dog that every day you have to unwind. This dog wakes up, wound up like a clock.
Okay.
And you have to unwind it. And if you don't unwind it, it's just going to keep getting tighter and tighter and tighter every day until it does something. And then it releases all that. I healed. You know, I'm a healer now. You know, he feels like he's done something or something like that. Or it's just, I mean, it's not. And again, like it, you have to read between the lines here. I don't know. Even with dogs that are in front of me, I don't know the full context. Like I need to like handle work and see a dog live their life for a couple of days before I can really tell you exactly what's going on. So I'm just, you know, again, read between the lines, and everything that I say isn't going to be 100% a matter of fact because I don't know for sure. I'm just giving you, you know, a lot more information than you would just thinking on your own. So to really answer that question, it's more about mental stimulation than anything. I would say just getting that dog out to do stuff, getting a prey pole, which is basically like a big cat toy that you can play with him in the yard, and getting him to run and chase things around and use that prey drive and take that frustration and unwind that clock as much as you possibly can. I know, again, like with my personal dogs, we just got last week, right before Christmas, we got like 33 inches of snow. And I knew that I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to be clearing out snow for the next 2 days. The dogs can't move because it's literally over their head. It's up to my waist. They can't go out in the snow, whatever. So my point is once that snow was gone or once we cleared it, like I knew I had a lot of work to unwind with my dogs because they're just so pent up, and it's life. I mean, very rarely does somebody get to unwind their dogs every day the way that they should be, right? Just like with us, like we don't get fulfilled every day the way that we feel like we need to. It's never going to be the perfect storm, which is normal, and it's okay. I would say 99% of dogs in homes have jobs that they don't get to do. So it's not like we've got this dog. What the heck did we get ourselves into? But at the same time, you need to really be mindful of the dog you have and the caliber of dog you have. This animal is supposed to be historically living on a farm, chasing animals that are the size of trucks around and pushing them in different directions all day long. Sleeping outside, sleeping in the barn, sleeping, you know, killing mice for food. Like these are very high caliber working dogs. And if they're not getting some of that release out in some way, it's going to stem up in other places and it's going to dilute into other places of frustration. And you're going to see it as aggression and reactivity, but really they're just bored.
Okay. Makes sense.
Yeah. So going back to a little bit more of the obedience, because that's the most important thing here is when you're on your trail and you're walking and you ask Rizzo to sit and he doesn't, that's an immediate response to your obedience, right? So and I want to go back to what you said because I appreciate and respect and understand the things that you're saying, although as a professional, I have to be devil's advocate and say it doesn't really matter because a lot of people do obedience in an unrealistic environment that isn't reality. And so you kind of trick your mind to say, my dog will sit down, stay, and heal or whatever inside the house with literally virtually almost nothing going on. Or if we do it outside, it's not in a realistic environment where there's other dogs and things like that, which is totally normal. I mean, that's normal. It's not your fault. It's not a bad thing. But I my job is to tell you that there is a significant difference between the two, because you're going to be frustrated as heck sitting there going, he sits, you know, before I feed him every night, he stays, he doesn't la la la, right? And it goes down the line. But then when you go outside, it's whoop, what's this? That's normal. But at the same time, you have to understand that there's a significant difference between the two environments, significant for the dog. So you just have to copy and paste the things that you're doing inside to outside and really audit where you're at with your obedience, which means you have to start working a little bit more outside. You also have to start working inside with more distractions. So putting him into a sit stay and, you know, throwing treats across the room, getting the other dog to run around, get, you know, stuffed dogs, ring the doorbell, knock on the, do all this stuff that is out of normal for him. Because if you put him into a routine, an obedience routine every night before he eats or whatever, it really, it doesn't matter in the real life. Because that's like, you know what I mean? That's really,
yeah.
I tell people all the time, like when they come in, their dog knows, you know, sit down, stay, heel, whatever. I can't tell you, there's a very high percentage of those dogs who won't do that out of context of the routine or without like the hand command of like sit because I have food, which I demonstrate a lot. I demonstrate a lot to people where they think their dog knows sit, and I'm not going to lie, most of the dogs that come in don't know sit. I know that that sounds silly and you're like, how is that possible? But dogs get into such a routine that if we hold a piece of treat up in the air or even our arms to fake like we have a piece of food and we say Pizza Hut, cheesecake, carrots, whatever, the dog's going to sit. They don't actually know the behavior in an isolated thing, which means it doesn't exist. Your sit doesn't matter. So if you look at your dog right now, Rizzo, sit, and he doesn't sit and he goes, what's that? You know, or down or whatever. And again, I take this with a grain of salt. I'm not saying that your dog doesn't know sit. I'm just saying that keep into consideration, and you have to audit and be honest with yourself, because after this phone call, that's all that matters is like, okay, we need to really figure out what he knows well and what we think he knows. And a lot of times dogs don't know what they think they know. And they're like, well, at home and with food and with treats. And I'm like, right, that's good. It's a good start, but it doesn't matter. If your dog can't do it in a semi-realistic environment, like just being outside with no distractions, and you ask your dog to sit and they won't sit for more than 10 seconds, that's a problem. The reactivity shouldn't matter because you can't get past that very small step. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So just keep that in mind. And that's something that you'll have to like work through moving forward of, okay, again, going back to the very basics. And that's why I asked you, what's your normal thing? Well, if we go out for a walk in a trail and we're on a hike, and we ask him to sit, about 5 seconds later, if he sees another dog, he's up. So to me, I stop right there. I'm like, I don't care what he does after that. I don't care how reactive he is, how nasty he is, or how happy he is, how excited he is. Your sit is being, your basic, very basic obedience is being broken after 5 seconds. 2 seconds, 10 seconds, whatever. And that's why I always tell people, if you have, you know, like I said in the beginning, if you have behavioral problems, I don't care about them if your obedience is not good. Because you can't, that's like trying to build a house without a foundation, where you're like, no, just put the wood up and let's just live in there. It's like, no, there's so much groundwork and foundation that has to be built before you have a really structured, strong house. So yeah. I don't want to say I don't care in a sense of it doesn't matter, because it does. I'm just saying, if you go out and you ask him to sit and he doesn't immediately, like your obedience is something you should be focusing more on instead of how do I shut this off versus what are the things and the behaviors and the obedience I need to help modify this shut off.
Okay. Makes perfect sense.
Cool. So That's going to be my suggestion, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more, but you have to work on those types of things. And again, you have to get creative. That's all up to you. It's in your hands to go out and work on that sit for long periods of time and, you know, do it around squirrels and, you know, go out and find a distraction. Go out and find maybe a dog in a yard that's barking at you or two squirrels fighting in a tree or something that he's interested in. Put him in a sit and see where you're at. Catch him, say no. And then, but your communication and your relationship also has to like be good too, because then you have to be able to tell him break and things like that. You have to be able to tell him like, okay, now you can break. Because that's the other thing a lot of people struggle with is they tell their dog what they can and can't do, but they never give them a very formal, clear, okay, now you can be a dog. So you're never happy because you're doing something unrealistic that nobody in the world can ever do. Can't ever get a dog to work all day, every day, all the time. It's never going to happen for anybody. So you have to take into consideration, you know, how well your relationship with him is too. So if you go out and you ask him to heel or sit or focus or whatever, and you're only doing it in times when you see a dog, it's not going to be good, because two things happen. Is you're setting him up to do obedience, and you're conditioning him that if you ask him to do something, he's going to be searching for that other dog. So you want to mix it up as much as possible. So you're going out and you're asking him to sit, good sit. You may bring some treats or his favorite toy, and you can pay him after, and you switch up and you mix the duration and the distraction and all that stuff, and you get really good at it, and then you give him a break, and that break is, you know, important for him, and it's important for you that when you say break, okay, now you can be a dog or whatever. And you're not going to do that every time you see a dog. You're going to randomly do that. That way, when you need it, it's like clockwork. It's no big deal. And it's clear for him, you know, too. I think that that's important for him too, is if you ask him to sit, right? And you do, say you go on an hour walk, just to make it easy. You go on an hour walk, hike type thing. And every 10 to 15 minutes, you put him into a sit and you hold it for 30 seconds and you give him a break. 30 seconds to 45 seconds, whatever. And then you give him a break. Well, if you see three dogs, your sit, you know, your sit and stay obedience is going to be outweighing the realistic time that, you know, you actually need it. So he's not going to think anything of it. But you have to practice it. You can't. That's what people do, is they go out and they only want to heal their dog if there's another dog or a distraction. They only want to sit their dog if it's you know, there's a bus or whatever the environment is. You know, whenever there's that, they need that. But you need to make sure you're going out and you're practicing. Hey, can we sit? Can we stay? Can we, you know, whatever? That's huge, because too many times people will only try to do obedience that's kind of half in an environment that is geared towards, oh, there's a dog. Because then the dog triggers off obedience. You've conditioned the dog to know that when you ask him to sit, there's going to be a dog, something like that. So anyway, there's a lot of that going into it. But the majority of my consulting and my training really goes back down to your basic foundational obedience. And that's what I would highly suggest you to work on. Now, there's that. The other thing about inside, things like that, you know, we go back to obedience. So your dog's inside. He's obviously not trained well enough to be off leash. So I would keep him on the leash for a bit, you know, and then the question is, how is his place? How is his stay? Things like that. Because you got to think, like, as an animal, you have to have really good, I mean, sometimes you just get good genetics and dogs don't care when people walk in and they're like, yeah, whatever. And then other times dogs, you know, come up, wag their tail, and then they go lay down after they investigate. But with Rizzo, somebody's going to come in and he's going to be A, already wound up like a clock, B, a healer. So he's going to be right there like, great, I have something to do now. Thank you very much. And C, his obedience and your relationship with him may be lacking. Therefore, like, if somebody came, so, and again, I don't want you to think to I don't want you to have an unrealistic objective to say that my dog's not going to react when people come over, ring the doorbell, walk in, whatever. That's not realistic. My dogs, if somebody rang my doorbell right now, my dogs would bark. I don't care. I'd like that. Thank you. Now, go lay down. Go to your place. Go to your bed, yeah. Whatever. And then again, that's where like you have to really audit. Because I think in situations like this, people are just trying to turn off that dog. Like the dog in them. You're trying to turn it off. When you're asking a living, breathing animal to, you know, to live with you and coexist with you and your family. And we just want them to do the things that we want them to do without, like, you know, you have to think, like, what type of training have you done to really make that successful? And so that's where, again, the obedience comes in. How is your place command? Well, not good. It doesn't really exist. So what are you supposed to do then? I mean, if somebody comes and rings your doorbell, what type of plan and what type of obedience do you have other than grabbing the collar and telling the person to hold on and just wheeling the dog away into the crate into the other room? Not that that's bad because that's successful, but it's not getting you to a point where then you can have people over successfully, because then you're building that tension and that frustration as the dog's away, that suppression, right? The dog is like still wanting to get out of that room and just go nip that person until they leave or whatever. So again, that's where your obedience comes in. Teach them to go to their bed on command, teach them the down, teach them the stay. And then you have to proof that out for a long period of time in order for you guys to remotely be successful. You can't just teach them go to your bed or go to your place, downstay in a week and then say, okay, yeah, I like it. Let's have people over. That takes a lot of incremental work, you know?
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
But I would keep him on a leash. And when you have people over, work on your leave it, work on your down, your place. In a place, like if you watch, you know, my videos and talk about sending your dog to a location, sending your dog to a place. I mean, that's so big that's like one of the big commands and behaviors that I teach dogs, because it's just so relationship building too. It's a micro macro type thing. The small picture is your dog's learning how to go to a targeted area on command. But the bigger picture is you're taking the steering wheel every time you tell your dog to do that. So you go to your place, the dog can't get off that place till you break him or recall him. Your dog has to be on this, you know, location until you say otherwise. And that creates that threshold and that relationship of like, okay, I'm going to be obedient. I'm going to stay here until you tell me I can get off. You know, just like with kids, it's like, go to your room until I tell you otherwise. Why? It doesn't matter. You know, you don't want to have that conversation of like constant because I said so, because just respect it and understand that it's for everyone's best benefit or whatever, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be your inside game plan. Obedience, leash work, prong collar. I mean, you can use the e-collar if you'd like, but that's got to be like, you know, introduced to a point where he understands the conditioning process and he understands the stimulation and all that stuff.
Did my screen just go weird?
Yeah, it just went real weird.
I don't know why.
I've never seen that.
I haven't either. 1 second.
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay, I don't know what I did, but it worked. Sorry. Anyway.
Yeah.
So what about when he's outside? I mean, we try to keep the e-collar on him when he's outside. We're in the house and he just cuts loose, whether, you know, when he sees anything beyond the fence. And, you know, I've tried to use the e-collar when he's outside, and sometimes he's so worked up that the e-collar doesn't faze him. He just wants what he wants so bad. And it's constant. Doesn't matter how much he's been worked with that day. Doesn't matter how much he's been gotten his energy out. It's consistent.
Sure. And that's something that, like, you know, as human beings, we have to respect too, as an animal is doing, you know, like the birds are chirping, tell them to quiet down. It's like, no, that's what they do.
Yeah.
You know, dogs are, they're dogs, you know, they're going to see dogs on the other side of the fence. They're going to want to go and create that frustration and bark. And it's just, it's so like, and I don't get overworked about those little things that dogs are dogs. I mean, I don't mind it, because I think at the end of the day, you know, the template is going to be the same about, okay, don't try to train your dog not to be a dog. train your dog to listen to you when they're being a dog. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So would you, you know, would you suggest going out there, you know, having, giving him the commands to come to you, to sit, to come, which, you know, sometimes depending on what the situation is outside, he will, you tell Rizzo, come, and he comes, but it only seems to be like with one dog, one neighbor dog who can do that with, everything else is off limits.
Yeah, it's the same.
So, you know, should we be running outside and doing the commands every time he goes out there?
Well, I think it's the same template as the sit. It's the same thing. It's like, hey, I asked my dog to sit, and in some circumstances he does it, and then others he doesn't. What gives? It's like, no. He'll listen under certain circumstances because it's convenient for him, and he's not conditioned to do anything, you know, more than that. We haven't pushed him over that ledge of conditioning, you know, and that's just part of training. It's just like with us as human beings. Like, we want to learn how to run long distance, right? Well, where do we start? We don't go out and say, hey, and that's basically the question that I'm hearing. And I know you're not, you don't, that's what I hear when we ask those questions, just so you know, is like, I want to, you know, I'm your coach. I'm your consultant. I've done what you want to do 1,000 times or more, you know? And you say, I want to learn how to run to be a long distance runner of, you know, 50 miles every three, whatever. Right. And you're telling me, yeah, I tried 20 miles yesterday and it just, I wasn't doing good. And I'm like, yeah, you're not there yet. You can't start off with 20 miles a day. You can't even do 3 yet. You got to slow it down and let's create a, you know, a strategy here of what you can accomplish realistically per day. And that's the same thing with what I'm hearing is my dog is off leash. Sometimes he listens, sometimes he doesn't. What gives? What do we do? Well, how's your recall? How's your off leash recall? Where does that exist? How much have we worked on it? How good is it? And that's going to be your answer. Not that great, not that responsive. How much have we used e-collar conditioning in a non-corrective way to communicate things like that? That's the template that's going to keep coming up for you guys, which it does for a lot of people. You're having normal behavioral nuisance behaviors throughout the house that a lot of people deal with, but your obedience and control doesn't match that, right? You're frustrated, which I get. You're like, my dog won't come back when this dog's out, but it's like, where's your recall? It's not your dog isn't listening. It's because your recall isn't good. So you're not going to be able to stop him. You know, same thing with like pulling on the leash, for an example. My dog pulls on the leash. How do I stop that? You can't. Your dog has 4 legs. They're outside. They're breathing in all of this, you know, primal stuff, birds, chipmunks, rabbit poop, deer, skunks, whatever your environment is. And they've never been taught how to heel and walk nicely on a leash. And you're using a harness and you're yanking and cranking and yelling. And you're frustrated that your dog won't walk nicely and won't. So don't try to figure out, how do I stop my dog from pulling? How do I get my dog to heel? How do I teach my dog how to heel? So it's the same template of just putting in the work to teach your dog. My dog won't come back when called because they're barking at the other dog. Recall. My dog pulls on a leash. Heel. My dog goes after other people. Leave it, place, stay, all that stuff is going to counter condition. So for me, it's really about, if you have the most aggressive, nastiest, man-eating dog on the planet, but your obedience is good, then it doesn't matter. I mean, it matters. You know what I mean? Like, for me, that's what it comes down to, is control. I don't care what your dog feels internally that they want to do. It's your responsibility as a dog owner to make sure you can control and holster that loaded gun, no matter if it's one end of the spectrum or the other. I would much rather have a well-behaved, aggressive dog, human-biting dog under really great control than an uncontrolled, friendly dog any day of the week. I would much rather be around a well-mannered, controlled, aggressive dog than a really uncontrolled, happy, in your face, scratching your whole body up, you know, jump, pulling you over. I would much rather be around an aggressive, controlled dog any day of the week. So you just have to think and audit about the control you have and how much time and energy and attention you've really put on that obedience to counter the things that you want. My dog will not stop reacting. How is your obedience? My dog won't come back off the fence. How is your recall, etc.? Those are things that you have to really like think about, because I can tell you very confidently that if you work on your recall outside of the other dog being on the other side of the fence and you slowly transition to those environments, you're going to be 1,000 times better than where you're at now. Same thing with the obedience out on a walk. Same thing with the leash work in the house when you have people over. If your place and your downstay is really great and you have that obedience to just look at your dog and they go, oops, I don't want to make a mistake, you're going to be more successful than just trying to figure it out when somebody comes over.
Okay. Makes sense to me.
Yeah. So anyway, guys, I think recap is just you guys getting back down to the basics and use that template. Every single time you think about a problem with your dog, think about what you've done to counter those innate, primal, healing type of tendencies and behaviors. And like I said, it's not appropriate for your dog to bite and react. None of that is like, oh, he's a healer. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying the dog is meant for that. I'm saying that's there, and you have to do a really great job and spend more time with a healer to outlet those things than you would other dogs. You know, because you got a really high-end working dog that is trying to work, but it's just not doing the right thing.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, perfect.
I know it's a lot of information, but just work on it. Be consistent. I think that's the biggest thing. To be consistent, make sure you're enforcing things, your equipment is fit properly, things are charged. Do the best you can to, you know, watch different videos on the internet and, you know, purchase, you know, there's things you can purchase too for whatever, and just try to do your research on how to do everything properly. And I think that you guys will be in a better spot.
One other quick question. So trying to brush his teeth and groom him, same situation, aggressive, you know, just kind of slowly work up to it, you know, with using those, yeah, all those commands, or is there another way to approach that?
I think it's more about just desensitization and conditioning. Naturally, dogs don't like it. They don't like it. They don't like somebody jamming something in their mouth, and they don't like, right, you know, getting their nails trimmed. It's a very natural thing for dogs to absolutely hate. So you have to do the best you can to condition that dog and you know, get the nail trimmer out, touch your dog's paw with it, walk away. And you have to do that for, you know, 100 times a day until they condition. They're never going to love it. They're never going to sit there and go, cheese, and hold their paws up like, you know, cut my nails and brush my teeth. It's something you have to condition. And sometimes, again, it's one of those things that you have to almost make them do it because they don't like doing it. And we have, you know, sometimes there's things you can't do. Just because we're humans and they're animals doesn't mean we can change everything all the time and we can modify and make them like certain things. That's not fair for us to think. It's normal. Oh, my dog hates their nails being trimmed and their teeth brushed. Yeah, so does every other dog ever. You know, unless they were conditioned at a very young age to come and get that done, think about it. How often do we try to trim nails and brush teeth? Once every X amount, once every month, once every 3 months, 6 months, once every year, once every whatever. It's something that they're not used to. And it's going to take them time to condition to it. And it's very normal. So you just have to understand that what that problem is very normal. And you just have to spend some time conditioning it and desensitizing with it.
Okay. All right. Sounds
all right.
Good. Okay.
All right, you guys. It was nice to meet you. Have a wonderful day. And good luck with everything, okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Appreciate right. it.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
wrapping up this podcast, you guys saw, you know, a lot of the things that I talk about frequently is the template of, if you have a problem with your dog, you really have to figure out what your solutions are, what your obedience is going to do. As you guys may or may not see some of my YouTube videos where somebody comes in with a behavioral problem, one of the first things I talk about is, where's your obedience at? You don't like your dog pulling. You don't like your dog barking. How's your heel? How's your leave it? Where's your engagement? Where's your relationship? So I'm going to keep working hard at trying to educate and help people out with their dogs and motivate people to continue to work with their dogs and get better. As always, I appreciate you guys so much for following along with this process. And it's got its ups and downs with consistency, I know. And that's you know, the world is a crazy place and things get busy. And we had a lot of exciting things coming up for this next year, as I'm sure a lot of people do for 2021. It's a year to look forward to get over 2020. Although I will say I'm very grateful 2020 was a groundbreaking year for us, for sure. Lots of exciting things to come. I can't wait to share with you guys. We got a lot of different new things going on in the YouTube channel, new equipment, new branding. The Upstate Canine Academy logo has been rebranded, and the Tom Davis logo is in the process of being rebranded. So lots of new merchandise, lots of new stuff for 2021, and we got some exciting news to hopefully announce in the next couple weeks. So anyway, thank you guys for rolling with me, hanging out with me. I hope you have a wonderful day. If you haven't yet, do me a solid favor. Follow us on Instagram at Tom Davis, at Upstate Canine Academy. Leave us a review on your podcasting platform. Screenshot this, share it on your Instagram, tag me. I'll repost you and congratulate and thank you so much for listening. I appreciate you guys. Anyway, I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.